Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear. Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Today is November 9th, 2016. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. It's the day after the election. And I'm so glad I have that in my entry is that says love is greater than fear, because we certainly need to exercise that. As most of you know, I am the flaming liberal on this radio station, or one of the few. And to be honest, I'm petrified of what 4 years of Trump, Pence, 4 years of a Republican Congress and Senate look like, the Senate and Congress. Maybe that's the bad medicine that we're going to need to actually turn this country around. So let me get right to my interview today. This morning we have with us Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. He had a previous meeting the last time we were supposed to speak, so I want to bring him right in so we can get a full hour with him. Thank you, Chuck, for joining us.
No, it's great to be here, Lonnie, on this sad day.
The sad day, yeah. Well, as I told to our listeners, as I told Chuck before we got on the air, for me personally, it's somewhat of a comfort for me to have a progressive on the line instead of somebody who's going to try to convince me that Donald Trump is actually a good alternative to Hillary Clinton. So I see them both as evil people, and I want to call him President Pussy Grabber. That's, my name for him. To be honest, that's what we're going to have, 4 years of really outrageous. I kind of am afraid for the guy. I think Mike Pence is going to have him knocked off if he tries to fuck the system, to be honest. It's like scary. So thank you, Chuck, for joining us.
I think
us.
He has a good, well, I think he has pretty great survival instincts, as he's demonstrated with his four bankruptcies and all of his chaos throughout his life. So
true.
He understands, like most bullies, he picks fights with people he can beat up on and shies away from ones with people that he can't. So I think he understands how much he owes the Christian right. He's promised them the Supreme Court. He's going to defer to Mike Pence on all the religious stuff.
Religious.
That's one of the things we need to be worried about, because I think he's going to deliver on all that stuff for them.
Yeah. So. Well, I hope not. I hope that we can get the Democrats to do, we've had 8 years of obstructionism with Barack Obama, and I certainly hope that they have taken notes and are going to exercise their lessons, because, I feel like our country has just taken a big, huge 70-year step backwards. I mean, I call them the American Taliban. We are going to see the hoods come out. The KKK hoods are going to start coming out. And I wouldn't doubt if we don't start seeing burning crosses across America,
Well, I'm not sure about that, but it'll continue the process that started during the Reagan backlash of just rolling back more and more of the things that keep the right in check. I think it's going to be more gradualism, probably, especially as they add the Supreme Court justices, right?
Yeah. Well, let's hope that, wouldn't that be great if we could have 4 years of Supreme Court justice seats unfilled? Wouldn't that be really awesome? I mean, right now we have Scalia open, and we're going to have two of the old guys probably croak in the next few years. You know, I wouldn't put it past the Republicans to poison a few of those Supreme Court justices just so they can get in.
The thing is, I'm not sure about that, but I do think that the Democrats won't hold the line. And say they do. Let's just postulate that they
they have courage.
Yeah, I mean, let's say, currently it takes 60 votes to break a filibuster. I think if the Democrats had gotten back control of the Senate, and Hillary had won, that there were a lot of signs that the Democrats were going to get rid of that filibuster blockage for the courts. And I think the Republicans will do the same thing if the Democrats try it. I think the filibuster is on its way out because it relied in the past on the parties having sort of a friendly relationship, outside of the Senate chambers, that, shake hands, smoke cigars, or whatever it was that they did together. That's not been the case ever since.
Hired child prostitutes, that's what they did together. We know what
right,
they did
exactly.
together. They hired, and so that behavior is going to be encouraged by Donald Trump. I mean,
right.
I really, honestly, to me, the hypocrisy of America looms large. And not that I'm a big Clinton fan, because I think she's exactly more of the same, but we could have fought that off a little bit. I actually, that's why, although I have to admit, I did not vote for her. I did not vote for president.
Well, you live in Oregon.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. Because I lived in Oregon, and I knew there would be enough low-information voters who would vote for her. I mean, to be honest, Chuck, how do you think this is going to reflect on us as, on nuke truthers? I refuse to call ourselves anti-nukers, but nuke truthers.
The wheels have been turning on that ever since it became clear that Trump was going to win at least Wisconsin. And I thought, oh my God, he's actually going to become president. So I've had to start thinking about this. But just to go back to the Hillary question,
mm-hmm.
she was a terrible candidate for the Democrats to put up.
She was
this time.
Well,
she
Democrats
was so hopelessly tainted. All of the things that they were saying about her in terms of being crooked, being bought off by the corporate elites, are absolutely true and demonstrable. So it's in an election year when a lot of angry white poor people are tired of the elites screwing them. They could overlook. If they didn't agree with his racism, they were willing to overlook it to get at the elites that had been screwing them for decades. So, she was the wrong candidate. And ironically, socialist Bernie Sanders, had probably, we'll never know because you have to test it in an election, but he could have had a better chance. He was polling better a few months ago versus Trump and, possibly could have won this election.
You mean if the Democrats hadn't have stolen the primary and perpetrated election fraud against the Democratic Party?
Well, you and I are less clear on exactly how much of that happened, if any. So, I don't know. But we do know that the Democratic Party, did everything they could to help Hillary. And you're saying that they did things that were illegal, too, in addition to tilting the field.
They did do things that were illegal. I mean, we know that in California they destroyed ballots. We know they stole. They did not count all the ballots. I mean, we know it has actually been well-documented election fraud. Donna Gilmore and I talked about this off the air quite a bit because she was very involved in the Bernie campaign. The thinking, though, behind Bernie's acquiescence is the fact that if he had challenged the election fraud, there is no mechanism for him to be reinstated in time to become a viable candidate. So when there's election fraud perpetrated in this two-party system, even if you see it straight out and you want to pursue it, you have to go through the courts. There's not enough time between the primary and the general election.
Yeah. This has been a problem. I mean, as somebody who was a little kid was following Oregon politics because my dad was involved in it, you know, there would be things that would be spotted, you know, a couple of weeks before an election. And because the court system's slow, nothing could be done about it until after the election.
That's exactly
right. You could have some bad publicity maybe, but that would be about it. You couldn't actually reverse things.
Exactly. So now here we are with the American Taliban about to take over the White House. I mean, to be honest, I'm going to have to do a bunch of tapping because these people scare the daylights out of me. I feel like with Republican Congress, Senate, and presidency, I mean,
they're not united on everything. This is where we have to figure out. I mean, it's very hard to figure out where Donald Trump is beyond his five outrageous talking points of, you know, we're going to build a giant wall and all the rest of the things that he claims he's going to do. Where does he come down on nuclear power?
He's pro-nuclear.
He's pro, but so was Hillary. Hillary.
That's true. Very, very
Hillary is 100% pro-nuclear.
100%. True.
And so to what extent does he care? It hasn't been a theme. The theme that he's been stressing in the energy area is let's put these coal workers back to work. Mm-hmm. Let's get coal going. Now, to what extent does he feel like he wants to prop up the nuclear power industry? Well, to some degree, the nuclear power industry has burrowed its way into the Democratic side of the ledger really effectively and kind of figured that's where the center of power was. They made a miscalculation. They didn't bet on Trump so much. You know, Exelon's located in Illinois. They're tight with Obama. They're tight with Hillary, and they're tight with Governor Cuomo, who just bailed them out in New York State. They're tight with Cory Booker. The Republicans have been supporting this as well. But in the past, on some of these nuclear questions, in the whole issue, moving to nuclear weapons, of reconstituting our nuclear weapons manufacturing capacity, which is something that Obama promised when he signed the new agreement with the Russians on reducing warheads. He promised the Republicans in the Senate that he would, spend $50 billion over the, you know, start in motion spending $50 billion over the next 20 years to rebuild our ability to continue to make new warheads. So that's $50 billion. Well, the Tea Party Republicans have actually been our biggest ally in fighting that in Congress, because that's new money. And spending new money means breaking out of the rules that govern the budget right now, which is an ever-tightening federal budget in order to supposedly shrink the deficit. I think we're still in that position now where we can make an argument that some of the things that promote both the nuclear weapons manufacturing agenda, but also the nuclear power agenda, are really expensive new items. And I think that's one of the fissures that we have to exploit. Is this is a budget buster? It doesn't make sense. Let's let the economy, let's let the market decide on nuclear and not subsidize it federally. They're certainly going to try to cut the subsidies for wind and solar. I mean, maybe they won't cut them until 2020, but they won't renew them. But I think we've got a chance of killing off some of these new reactor programs, like the small modular reactors program, which the Democrats have been promoting heavily, because it's new spending. So in a way, that gives us
an inch in.
Although, on the other hand, this is where, you know, we're reading the tea leaves about Trump right now. We have no idea really what he's going to do. But he promised all this infrastructure improvement. So perhaps the nuclear power industry will be able to lump their new nukes into infrastructure improvement category. Because he apparently is going to deficit spend, even though he claims he's going to pull another Reagan, only on steroids. Cut cut taxes enormously for the wealthy and then spend a lot of extra money on infrastructure. In the case of Reagan, it was cut taxes on the wealthy and spend a bunch of money building up our military. He's made some promises along those lines, but I think more he's promised he's going to rebuild roads and bridges and all that kind of stuff. And that would fit in with him trying to satisfy those angry white workers in the Midwest by, you know, giving them jobs doing stuff like that. But the question is nuclear power going to be, is new nuclear power going to be infrastructure that Trump will be supporting, or is it a budget buster that we can successfully fight and say it's something that is new money that doesn't need to be spent, and let's let the market decide. And I don't know the answer to that, but we need, that's one of the things we need to be looking at.
Well, we can certainly push in that direction. That's not a bad idea.
But the other thing is what do we do with the waste? Now, it's been an interesting paralysis that we've had at the federal level since Obama was elected. He promised Nevada that Yucca Mountain wouldn't open up. And there are a lot of technical problems with the Yucca Mountain site. It's infiltrated with water much more than they knew when they first started investigating it. So it would leak much more quickly than it's supposed to under the regulations. They've had to continue to try to bend the regulations to make it legal. And now they're realizing they have to add drip shields over the top of all their casts just to prevent water from getting onto the casts and breaking them down more quickly. But Yucca Mountain's been kept on life support by the Republicans, who have insisted that, you know, just as part of their resistance to anything Obama does, basically, that this had to go forward, and there have been bipartisan efforts in the Senate to try to set up interim storage sites as a way to get around having to make a final decision on this and keep the nuclear power from suffocating in its own waste backup or suffering bad PR because it, you know, doesn't have an answer to the waste issue. And the Republicans in the House have been blocking it. So now what's going to happen? Are they going to try to push Yucca Mountain down Nevada's throat? Nevada voted against Trump. He doesn't particularly feel like he owes them anything, probably. And I'm sure there are members of the House who see this as their chance to jam Yucca Mountain back down their throat. So I would not be shocked in the slightest to see that come back as the main initiative, federal initiative, is reviving Yucca Mountain and maybe shelving this plan that they've been working on, that they would have gone forward with if Hillary had been elected, to set up an interim storage site in either New Mexico or Texas. Or maybe they'll do both, you know, who knows. But we can expect some action in the coming year on the waste disposal issue, I would think, and a lot of danger that something that is not scientifically sound but is politically popular with Republicans will get pushed through.
Wow. Well, that was quite an answer.
Yeah.
That is, I to be honest, as far as the storage goes, I don't think there really is a solution. Obviously, Yucca is not the answer. Really, this is the hard part. This is why I believe that nuclear power plants and nuclear facilities and all uranium processing plants need to be shut down immediately, because there's no answer to the waste that it causes. There is zero answers. Like, until we have an answer to the, I mean, imagine we're producing this waste, constantly producing this waste, using this energy source that supposedly provides us with a viable alternative to coal, which it does not, because we don't use near the, it doesn't even have the capacity, and yet it produces a waste that is highly toxic, and we have nowhere to put it. So we're just, we're like Japan, those pictures of Japan with those waste tanks everywhere. Ours are just not as visible like they are at Fukushima, where you just have mounds and mounds and mounds of tanks. I mean, this might be something that you know about, Chuck. In terms of, you know how since the WIPP has collapsed and we can no longer store it underground there, and the NRC has asked has allowed all these nuclear power plants to continue storing their waste above ground near their facilities. We've had almost 2 years of that going on now.
Right.
So is the NRC beginning to feel any kind of a tight squeeze with all these mounds of nuclear waste sitting around all these nuclear power plants? Is there any conversation about the urgency to resolve this issue?
The NRC has some diligent people who are looking at the science and trying to figure stuff out. And then it has a lot of leadership and bureaucrats who see their main job as mollifying everyone and just keeping the nuclear power business going. And the second group are the ones that actually run the NRC and issue the statements from the NRC. There are technical people who are finding a lot of different problems in dealing with the waste. And since you've had Donna Gilmore on your show, she's probably told you about all of the problems they've discovered with dry casks.
Right.
And the varying abilities of different designs of dry casks to hold the high-level irradiated fuel from nuclear power plants in them. And the shock that they are beginning to realize that allowing nuclear plants to double the length of time that they keep their rods in the reactors from 3 to 6 years has resulted in much hotter, more radioactive fuel that is starting to break down much more rapidly than the other.
That is something that has not been discussed. Could you repeat that, and when did that happen?
In the 1990s, nuclear power was having trouble economically, kind of similar to how it is now. Natural gas was coming into the market at a really cheap rate, and nuclear plants were, you know, economically not holding up as well. So one of the thoughts that the nuclear power industry had was, if we refuel less often, then the plants are down less often. They make money when the plant's running and they're generating electricity and selling it. If they're down to refuel for a month, then they're losing money. They're spending money with the refueling process, and they're not generating any income by selling the electricity. So they began to extend the length of time between refuelings. It used to be every year. And it still is in some countries. Japan refuels every year still. To the extent they operate nuclear plants, they only have two running right now. But still, they have an annual cycle, just as the United States used to until starting in the mid-90s. And now most nuclear plants in the United States are on a two-year cycle. So they don't change a third of the fuel out until 2 years after the last time they did it. And each time they refuel, they take out a third of the fuel, the oldest fuel, and pull it out. And at this point, the oldest fuel is now 6 years old by the time it's taken out of the reactor.
Wow.
Instead of three. So those extra 3 years mean that it's bombarded by radioactivity for that much longer. It becomes both physically and radioactively hotter. And it stresses the zirconium cladding on the fuel rods, which already, you know, has some vulnerability to falling apart. And when it falls apart, then the uranium and other radionuclides that have been formed in the process of running a nuclear plant, of the fission process, fall to the bottom of whatever container they're in, whether it's a spent fuel pool or a reactor vessel or a dry cask wherever this material is, and becomes then a cleanup problem. And if you get enough material, potentially a criticality problem. You know, you could have a chain reaction. It would take a lot of material. You know, that's not a very likely scenario, but it's only a likely scenario if you have, like, for example, if you had
an earthquake,
complete failure, and all in one spot, and you had a pile of material that was radioactive enough to do that. But a fuel rod here and a fuel rod there, as it's been failing, wouldn't result in that. But it's really difficult then to get that material into a new container, and then it's sort of loose sitting in that container. And then now one of the advantages to storing fuel the way that they designed it all was that as long as it stays in those fuel rods, it's in a solid form, and you can move it into these dry casks, cool it down further, and then eventually put it into a long-term repository. That's been the theory. But if it starts falling apart, then it's much more expensive and dangerous for workers to try and handle it. So that's one of the things that the NRC is discovering, is that they're having danger of failed fuel has become much greater because of these high burn-up rates that they're allowing on their in the reactors. And they went from recommending that spent fuel be kept in pools for 3 to 5 years after it comes out of the reactor to now internally they're talking about this high burn-up fuel maybe should be kept in the spent fuel pools for 12 years. They're not admitting that, but Donna has found and others have found references to keeping it in the spent fuel pool longer so that it has more time to cool down before they move it into dry casks. And one of the things that Donna's been looking at is that there's really huge differences between the different types of dry casks that they've been using.
Right.
Some of them have really thin metal shielding, and others have much larger cast iron. And these are the ones that she favors, and it's what they do in Germany. They use these extremely heavy,
18 to 25 inches thick, as opposed to a half an inch or 3/8 of an inch thick in the 5/8 of an inch thick in the United States.
Right, and the United States has an overpack that prevents people from being radiated. You know, it has a sort of like a sheath over the top of concrete.
The downside,
you still are shielded, but it's not. But it's outside of the cask itself.
Right, and once they start leaking, you can't really go in and work on them, and there's no way to check on them. So the whole thinking behind the way the NRC is supposedly protecting this dangerous material is really sort of with blindfolders on. They really are refusing to actually be honest about the harm that they're causing our entire environment.
Well, and as you've seen with the different repository proposals, you know, originally in theory they all looked feasible, but as you examine them and as you actually experience them, in the case of Yucca Mountain, as they examined the site, they discovered they needed to put drip shields over the top of all of their casks to prevent them from breaking down more quickly than they're allowed under the law to allow that material to get into the groundwater, which is the groundwater that's under Las Vegas, by the way. And then in the case of WIP, those salt caverns were supposed to safely contain all of that waste in perpetuity, and it lasted about 15 years before they had to, plutonium and americium and all the rest of the radionuclides.
And they're continuing
coming
to
up
collapse.
To the surface.
It's not like
and
it
contaminating
was a
the entire system down there. They continue to have collapses much more rapidly than they had postulated, and it's only going to get worse. As Don Hancock from Southwest Research and Information Center has pointed out, is that as you have to restrict people going down there because of the radioactive contamination that's now occurred, then you have less people down there shoring up the walls and making sure that you don't have cavern collapses. So this probably, it would not shock me if they gave up on, if they had to close permanently the WIP site and just start all over again somewhere else and just, try to chalk that up for lessons learned, and we'll build our salt caverns differently, and we'll remember not to pack nitroglycerin into our waste tanks next time by adding nitrates.
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is, like, they're going to say, wipe, even if that action happened, it doesn't resolve the issue of contaminating the area of the entire Southwest. I mean, this whole conversation, this is the thing that just shocks me the most, I think, about the whole nuclear industry, is there is no resolution. I mean, it's like they're just going into a room, destroying it completely, going to get a new room, destroying it completely, going to get a new room and destroying it completely. And all the while, the waste in all the rooms, it's not like it goes away in a few years and the dust will cover it up and it's all going to be good. We're talking about literally destroying the environment of the United States across the country in perpetuity.
Well, I would say that describes our uranium mining pretty well, because it brings a lot of naturally occurring radionuclides to the surface and in ways that can harm people. The jury's still out in my mind as to whether or not these salt caverns will hold up over time. I mean, obviously they failed to a relatively small degree, but they still failed. They released radionuclides through their ventilation system, and they contaminated the air spaces down so that it's difficult for workers to go down there and work. But the question is, once those salt caverns seal up, will either dumb people later on or just misinformed people later on who have no idea go down and accidentally dig it up again, or will it be left alone and not get into the water table? Theoretically, they say yes, it will not get into the water table, but
what liars.
They've said a lot of things that have been wrong. So
I'm not
terribly confident.
I mean, this is the thing about the NRC. They will say whatever you want to hear, regardless of the facts. They do not care if they will lie to you straight up. I mean, honestly, the nuclear industry scientists, in my view, are not scientists. They're genociders. I have no respect for any of them, because everybody in the nuclear industry ought to be working to stop it immediately. That's how I feel. Like, their attitude is that it's worth the human risk. It's worth the million, 2 million cancers we get every year. It's worth the genetic deformations that per million people, we have 225,000 genetic defects that they accept. Over 32,000 cancers that they accept per million people. Multiply that. That's why our world is in a world of hurt, because of the nuclear industry. I mean,
it's an assault that's come from a lot of human-made sources,
and yes, it has.
And nuclear is one of them. You know, we have all these chemicals as well, and it's very difficult to sort out what, in some cases, some things you can identify. Leukemia, in certain cases, is most likely from a radioactive source, but there are some others that are sort of indicators. But then there are a lot of other cancers that can be caused by both chemical
just cancers, Chuck. Like, we're talking about increase in diabetes, schizophrenia, endocrine
birth
problems.
Defects.
I mean, a truckload and a trove load of things. And, you know, on this radio show, we started a new program called the Missouri Accountability Project with Drew Kuhn. He was a guest on my show, and now he has his own show talking about the radiation and the effects of it in St. Louis, right, from the World War II mess that they've got going on. They have an ongoing fire there. And this week he was talking about how it was because of the citizens there that they were able, and they had their scientific background, that they were able to identify these odd, peculiar diseases, and they tied it all together. This is how they discovered it. Unfortunately, most communities across the country don't have that kind of foresight or education to understand that they are being negatively impacted. I mean,
right.
And I think, you know, I've been grappling with this whole conversation since I discovered Fukushima was out of control. And one of the things that I've come to understand is, I am beginning to believe that the government sort of underplays the negative effects of the ongoing radiation from the Fukushima volcano, because we have our own Fukushima right here with the abandoned uranium mines. The abandoned uranium mines in this country is enough contamination. I mean, we have done not, the whole nuclear industry across the board, as far as I can see, in every single country. It doesn't even matter where you're at. They have enough power to make the governments just ignore and pretend the harm that the nuclear industry does to the environment.
Right.
How is it that we... the question is, how do we offset that? How do we get the people who are in power to accept the fact that we do not need nuclear at all? We don't need it. It's not a help. And I mean, you come in contact every single day with the people that are legislators and things like that. What is their conversation to you is that it's not that bad?
See, here's the thing. We have a really weird situation in that naturally, the left has a very has a lot of suspicion of capitalism, and with good reason. You know, capitalism has led to a lot of really bad decisions that harm people. Pure capitalism, when applied to nuclear energy, kills nuclear energy. The friend of capitalism is state control, because you know it was originally nuclear power was originally used to generate the materials for nuclear weapons, and obviously the United States and then Russia and then a growing number of countries wanted to have the ability either to make nuclear weapons or maybe reserve the right later on to do it. And so they all thought, you know, we need nuclear power plants. They in some cases have never admitted this desire, but for example, Japan has been reprocessing radioactive waste for decades and has an enormous arsenal's worth of plutonium sitting in Japan. It's estimated it would take them about a year to make nuclear weapons because of their ability, their rocketry achievements in terms of satellite launching and everything else. They could be a nuclear weapons power. That's one thing, actually, that if Trump really does follow through in terms of saying that our international alliances are not, you know, that important. We could see Japan break out and go ahead and say, we need to defend ourselves. Let's declare ourselves a nuclear weapons state. That is something that we need to be careful of. It's one of the reasons why, even though I'm not like a gung-ho internationalist and interventionist American, you know, like Hillary Clinton is, there's a danger to changing the international system somewhat, in that all of a sudden you add more nations to the nuclear weapons capable, and that adds more complications and more chances, puts more bullets in the Russian roulette chamber, you know, for a bad sequence of events to lead to a nuclear war.
I think that's one of the anxieties about
capitalism. If the more we can get capitalism to be applied toward nuclear power, the quicker it goes away. I think that's something we have to keep in mind, is that economics is not the friend of nuclear power.
That's true.
Even when they dumb it down and say they, you know, and reduce the amount of safety things that they need to do, it's still an extremely expensive way to generate electricity compared to the dropping cost of renewables now, which is great, and also natural gas, which is a temporary phenomenon due to fracking. But the encouraging thing is that there are capitalists and right-wingers who are making big money right now with wind and solar. And while I don't normally get excited for capitalists and right-wingers, you know, I'm hoping that they will, those that are making money in the renewable industry will prevail and continue to do that. When you've got West Texas and Western Oklahoma generating enormous amounts of wind power right now that they want to export into the South. That's radical. And these are not Greens who are doing this. These are T-Bone Pickens and, you know, other rich guys who see an opportunity to make some money. And so we're having a, you know, sort of a fight between interests, those who are generating power in ways that are more benign and that we like better, and those who want to keep generating it and increase things like nuclear, coal, and also natural gas, the fracked gas.
Well, as you said, Japan reprocessed its waste to extract the plutonium, correct? Like, that's what so this is really, this is my contention. This is why we have nuclear power plants, because that's the hidden back door to developing nuclear weapons. Because that is really what they want. They don't want look, these nuclear power plants do not generate enough electricity to make a massive impact on our on the environment, the energy environment. What they do
I mean, it's still about 19% of our electricity comes from nuclear. That's quite a bit. It's more than wind and solar.
Well, but you know what? It's only because wind and solar have been suppressed. If we had allowed wind and solar to really actually hit the market and take off like it could have and ought to have, like it naturally would have, it would far exceed. Look, in fact,
well, a lot of this would have happened sooner. But, you know, the global economy, which is, you know, part of what Trump was fighting against, because it's meant more and more of our materials are built in China. China is actually a key part of what has revolutionized the cost of wind and solar. They are building wind and solar at a faster clip than anyone else. They are producing solar panels in China at a much, much cheaper price than anywhere else. They've driven down the cost of solar enormously. So it's a kind of a weird thing. You know, I'm not convinced that this is healthy to have China be the world's manufacturer and shipping all of its products hither and yon, but in the case of wind and solar, when they grabbed onto that technology and did the thing that they do in China, which is produce a lot of it cheaply, that changed the equation. And at this point, now we have a virtuous cycle of the price coming down, sort of as occurred with microchips, where we can continue to see the cost and efficiencies get better and better and better with both wind and solar. Wind is actually improving as well, too, and it needed to. You know, it just was a little bit too variable. There are ways that they're improving now. It's consistency. It's not shutting down less frequently, so it's producing more steady power than it used to when they originally started out. That's the encouraging side of things. The question is, because Trump hates anything environmental, you know, and thinks climate change is a hoax and all the rest, and doesn't like China, you know, are we going to have some sort of tariffs on solar panels? You know, are they going to try to cancel the tax credits before 2020? You know, are they going to do things to try to slow down wind and solar so they can promote coal primarily, but also to some extent nuclear?
Hey, coal prices shot up this morning. I mean, coal is like, they're licking their chops. They're like, thank you, Jesus. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They are so ready for this one. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what exactly does happen in terms of how it all works in terms of the energy industry, because there's a lot on the line, and it's not, you know, a lot of people were really nervous about Trump having his hand on the nuclear button, but I contend that anybody in the White House takes their orders from the United States military. I don't believe
that. I totally agree.
And
I totally agree.
You know, we don't...
They would stop him from starting a war that they didn't want.
You know, he needs to, I mean, the picture of his son last night standing there next to him, and I couldn't even listen, but I watched it muted, with his son standing there fidgeting and tweeting, being exhausted, thinking he that child knows his life is about to be irrevocably changed. And, you know, like looking at what, I mean, I actually really am, I mean, personally, I do not trust Mike Pence at all. I think he is in with the fascists who would, in a heartbeat, shoot Donald Trump if they felt like he was getting out of control. I mean, I have no trust at all in Mike Pence and the American Taliban. None. Zero. And I just seriously, like, talk about having to put your courage feet on. Like, as an American, I'm mortified, but I'm also very afraid of what is going to happen on our planet. And I think the only thing that we can do is have the courage to stand up to these people and get more actively engaged politically and force our elected officials to stand up to these monsters, because that's who they are, well, you know.
And the other thing we've got besides doing that at the federal level on those issues is at the local level, in the blue states that didn't vote for Trump, I think we can continue the process we're in right now of creating our own regional models for how we do stuff. And that includes in the Pacific Northwest, shutting down the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant.
That's right.
Really building up our wind and solar capacity. And in fact, we're going to be issuing a report next week from economist Robert McCullough that shows that we can close the Columbia Generating Station, and because of power margins, because the demand for electricity is actually declining in the Northwest due to industry either going away or energy conservation measures like LED lighting, that we wouldn't even actually need to replace it. But if we did, we could replace it at lower cost with wind and solar now because the price has come down so much. So we're hoping that that report, which we'll be issuing next week, will help us convince other utilities besides Seattle. Seattle's taken the position that it favors closing the Columbia Generating Station if it can be replaced with non-carbon electricity sources. And we believe it can at an affordable price. And we're hoping we're going to be going on the road with all of the utilities that are part of the ownership of the Columbia Generating Station nuclear plant.
What are those utility companies that those of us that live in the Northwest could be contacting these utility companies, correct?
Well, there's two ways that the Northwest utilities relate to the Columbia Generating Station. They're the ones who are part of Energy Northwest, which is the remainder, what the new name for the Washington Public Power Supply System is, which is WPPSS. It was referred to in the old days as WHOOPS. Some older and people who lived in the Northwest in the 70s and 80s will remember that name. It was a consortium of somewhere around 100, depending on each reactor, utilities that publicly owned utilities that attempted to build five nuclear plants at the same time. They succeeded in completing one of them, which is now called the Columbia Generating Station instead of WHOOPS 2. It used to be called the WHOOPS 2 nuclear plant.
Which does sit on top of an earthquake fault, which your organization discovered.
Right. Well, we didn't discover it. The U.S. Geological Survey discovered it, but we put out a report publicizing what they had found. In any case, that one was finished in 1983. The others were canceled. And we've continued to pay through Bonneville's rates for two of the ones that weren't finished, plus the one that was finished. And it constitutes about 37% of the electricity cost to Bonneville customers is for nuclear power.
Wow.
While producing about 10% of its electricity.
Wow.
So it's one of the reasons why Bonneville's rates, while cheaper than the rest of the country, are not as cheap as they used to be before these nuclear projects.
Wow.
But anyway, to get back to that, after the WHOOPS financial collapse, and the other two reactors that were not, that had not signed contracts with Bonneville to guarantee that they would buy the power from them or pay for them if they were canceled, they defaulted on their bonds, and the bondholders, who were individual citizens who invested in them, lost their money. The state of Washington reconstituted WHOOPS and set it up as a state-chartered corporation which is now known as Energy Northwest, that consists of 27 Washington public utility districts or municipal electric utilities, including such utilities as Seattle City Light, Tacoma Power, Clark County PUD, and all the different PUDs around Washington State. They in turn select members to an executive board, and then there are appointed members from the governor that make decisions on the operation of the nuclear plant. Those 27 utilities are ones we've been trying to talk to. We've been talking at great length with Clark County PUD commissioners. We did go to the Seattle City Council, and as I said, we got them to take a position for closure, but with the caveat that it would only be if it were replaced with renewable or non-carbon electricity. That seems to be the deal that is most popular and most saleable. It's very hard for us, and it's hard for us, you know, as people who care about climate change, to go around and try and convince people to shut down the nuclear reactor if it means burning more natural gas or even burning coal or something like that. So, you know, this is a position we're comfortable with, and we're hoping to get to the rest of those 27 utilities. And then beyond that, every Bonneville customer has a stake in this. Because, as I said, this is a large part of the budget, and we've been able to demonstrate that it's a money loser for Bonneville customers to keep operating this plant. So utilities like Eugene Water and Electric Board in your area, the Springfield Utility Board, you know, any publicly owned utility, any co-op, rural electric co-op, or any utility that's buying its power from Bonneville or some portion of its power from Bonneville, has a stake in this. Right. And if they would get organized and assert their voices in talking to the administrator, the Bonneville Power Administrator could actually close the plant.
Well, that would be if the administrator will call you back. I personally have reached out to my administrator in my local water district here 6 times. Yeah. He's never once returned my phone call. Not one time. They just
Elliot Mainzer meets with environmental groups in a very controlled fashion. I attend these meetings on a quarterly basis, and he is a very rational person. And like any prudent bureaucrat, he's not going to do anything that will get himself in trouble with his bosses. Mm-hmm. And his bosses are the president and the congressional delegation, because works for a federal agency. And without the backing of at least a good chunk of the electric utilities in the Northwest, he's not going to be able to close that nuclear plant, because the people in the Tri-Cities would throw a fit. They'd go absolutely nuts. Senator Murray supports the operation of the Columbia Generating Station enormously, and she's the most senior member of the Northwest delegation in Congress.
That's right. Her dad worked at Hanford. She's very much connected to the nuclear industry.
She is. And she's very comfortable there. And during the recession, she got a giant amount of cleanup money out of the stimulus package that Obama passed when he first came in. They never experienced the recession in the Tri-Cities. They actually were the only... SMSA that in the entire Northwest that continued to have rising property values and income levels and everything else, because they put a couple billion dollars into cleanup there, and they actually did some good things along the river. They actually did get some cleanup done. Less good with the tanks and with the plans for how you solidify that waste. They've been wasting a lot of money in that area, but they did spend some of that money to good effect. But bottom line is, unless we can get EWEB, Springfield Utility Board, Hood River Co-op, Northern Wasco PUD, Canby Electric, McMinnville, whatever their municipal utility is called, if we can get, even in Oregon, if we can get some of these utilities to tell the administrator, let's cut our losses on the nuclear plant and save some money. then I think that gives him the cover to say to, you know, Senator Wyden and Senator Murray and the rest, you know, I'm getting pressure to shut down this nuclear plant. It's not just the environmentalists now, it's also the utilities. And then that changes the equation. So that's what we're hoping to do. And this can be done without, you know, without any reference to the Trump administration. The question is, would they then jump in if their move was starting to form and try to pressure Bonneville, you know, from the administration? I don't know the answer to that, whether they would or not. Because ultimately, of course, Bonneville answers to the Secretary of Energy. And
I think we're going to see meet the new boss same as the old boss, because it's all run by the military. I mean, I do not have at all any prospects for thinking. I mean, I think that these people that are running this show are willing to just kill every single person in our country so that they can get as rich as they possibly can. They're war profiteers par excellence. That's my opinion. I mean, I don't trust them, and I don't.
Well, tell us what you really think. You know,
yeah, I will. You know how I am. I hide my true feelings all the time. So, well, you know what, Chuck? This has really been great. I have not really been able to. I wanted to talk to you about this whole concept of the threat of nuclear energy to our real environment and to our public health, because I think a lot of times we neglect how it really does affect us in terms of the effects on our environment and getting into it. I know that's one of the things I know that your organization really does look at. We don't have the time, though, however. It's 8:56. We just have a few minutes left. So I want to thank you.
Well, let's meet again and just talk about that.
Yes, because I think this is one of the reasons, if we can get people to understand the real nature, that is what astounds me the most, is the way all these elected officials, they kind of look at us when we call them up and say, you know, this stuff is dangerous, like we're just raving lunatics, like we just don't understand that it's just not that harmful, while cancer increases, genetic diseases increase. I mean, it's astounding to me, but there has to be some way that we can move through this. So I hope...
Well,
it's
difficult. I mean, you know, when you have really clear science on your side, such as, you know, a lot of scientific consensus on the effects of CO2 on the climate, you know, you can, for political reasons, you can still have a lot of controversy. And nuclear energy is just, you know, even more susceptible to, you know, the difficulty of proving your point because of politics, mm-hmm. and having enough scientists who are willing to repeat the falsehood, I would say, that this is not nearly as dangerous as these alarmists are saying.
Yeah.
And hiding behind the ambiguities of the difficulty of identifying specific cancers due to specific contaminants.
Well, that's what they rely on, isn't it? Is like that,
absolutely.
That ability to point the finger at somebody else. Well, look, we have about 45 seconds left. Chuck Johnson from the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility has been on the phone with us for the last hour. Thank you, Chuck, for joining us. I sincerely really appreciate you coming back on a regular basis and being a friend to our show. You provide,
well, I love doing it.
Well, you provide a lot of good information and actually a great perspective for me. Obviously. So I really want to thank you. I encourage people to put your courage feet on, get more actively engaged in politics, unless we want the American Taliban to really roll back the rights that we've gained in the last 70 years. And hopefully, Chuck, you'll join us soon.
I will. And let me just make one last statement.
I don't think you'll be able to. I don't think
you'll
be able
to. If you're Oregonian, go to our website. If you hear me over this soundtrack, go to Oregon CSR's website and help us shut down the nuclear plants. Thank you.
Thank you.